Please be advised. The following contains descriptions of violence and may not be suitable for all listeners.
Is there possible one for Alpha there?
They have now opened for us. They are inside. Copy it.
Ek staan af by klein welgevonden estate, Sierra's woonstelle nummer 21, Stellenbosch. Die opname begin.
Dat is de
It's the early hours of the 17th of March 2005, and Police Inspector Desmond Scher is making his way through a young woman's flat in Stellenbosch, South Africa. Using a handheld camera and speaking Afrikaans, he describes the shakily videoed scene we are watching. Panning from the living room to the kitchenette reveals a modest apartment, neatly furnished. A framed photo carefully positioned on the kitchen counter. A single plate and cup neatly placed on a dishwashing rack. The camera zooms in on a cell phone, sunglasses and a set of car keys on the counter. The unsteady footage moves down to a basket showing a till receipt from a Steers hamburger outlet. The camera moves on. At 3 minutes into the video, we see for the first time evidence of the brutality that had taken place at 21 Shiraz Apartments just a few hours earlier. It's as if the camera operator is trying to delay the inevitable, skirting around the couch in the living room before showing the full horror that awaits us. He pans past a woman's knee, up to a blood-spattered wall. We see an open magazine, almost impossibly resting on a pair of legs, and a television remote lodged between the couch and the side view of a pair of pajama shorts with pictures of sheep on them. But eventually, he has to complete his task, and Inspector Scher finally reveals a woman's bloodied body. There is no damage to her legs or waist, but as the camera pans up, the stomach-turning reality is revealed. It's hard to watch. She's been brutally bludgeoned and stabbed to death. There are many wounds to her head, face, and neck. What appears to have been a heavy object has left a gaping wound in her chest. Blood has spattered on the couch, the wall, the floor, the lampshade, and onto a photograph of a young woman and a man standing close together. Desmond Scher moves into the small bedroom, which contains a single bed. It is neat and tidy, revealing the orderliness of the person who lives here. But oddly, the single bed has been moved away from the wall on one side. Next, in the bathroom, the camera captures a palm print in blood on the wall. Blood in the sink, blood on a towel. This is where the killer must have cleaned up, washed his hands, and probably the murder weapon too. On the tiled floor, there are some blood marks and a bloodied hand towel with pieces of matted hair. In the final moments of the video, Inspector Scher zooms in on a framed collage of photographs hanging on the wall. The camera focuses on a portrait of a beautiful young woman dressed in a black evening gown. She has light brown hair and green eyes and a perfect smile that could light up a room. This is 22-year-old Inga Lotz, the same person now lying lifeless a few meters away. The camera lingers on her radiant face in the portrait, and then abruptly, the recording ends. But it marks the beginning of a decade-long investigation, several court cases, accusations, lies, and heartbreak. For not one, but two families.
Die tyd is 01:23. Die opname word beëindig.
This is the Inga Lott story, A Miscarriage of Justice. Over the next six episodes, myself, Catherine Rice, and co-producer Matthew Brown delve into the murder of Stellenbosch student Inga Lotz and the subsequent trial of her boyfriend, Fred van der Pfeffer.
From the very beginning, this was going to be a case that captured the public imagination. We're talking about a beautiful young woman, very brutally murdered. She literally sang in the church choir, and she was cut down in the prime of her life.
That was Anthony Altbecker, an author and justice policy advisor. He's taken a special interest in this case from the very start. Inga was the only child of Juanita Lotz, a physiotherapist, and Jan Lotz, a professor of radiology. They were a religious Afrikaans family, regularly attending the Dutch Reformed Church. Inga was an exceptionally talented child, both musically and mathematically. She matriculated in 2000 and was among the top five pupils in the Western Cape that year. Inga was also popular and outgoing, with an infectious laugh. Her best friend, Wimpy Boshoff, described her as magnetic, with a trail of male admirers. She excelled academically in her classes at the University of Stellenbosch, and it was here in her fourth year when she first met her boyfriend, Fred van der Pfeffer. The youngest of three boys, Fred cut a handsome figure. He was tall and quietly confident. They sat next to each other in class. Like her, he was studying actuarial science and had already started working at Old Mutual, one of South Africa's most well-known insurance companies. The pair made a striking couple, and although they had been dating for less than a year, their future appeared to be clearly mapped out. Inga had already prepared her parents for their imminent engagement. But some of Inga's friends would later claim in the media that all was not perfect and that Fred was jealous of her apparent flirtatiousness. On the 16th of March, a hot and humid Wednesday, the seemingly perfect couple's dream was destroyed. For Inga, it would mark the abrupt and cruel end of her life. For Fred van der Pfeffer, it would mark the start of the fight of his life.
Right at the start, the police believed that this was a crime committed by somebody close to Inga. Nothing appeared to be stolen except for a remote control that the killer presumably used to get out of the complex. Maybe a kitchen knife that is missing. There were no signs of forced entry. And it was the sheer amount of violence, the kind of violence that police associate with a crime of where something personal is at stake. Of course, when you investigate a crime like this, it's not a surprise if they look at lovers, boyfriends, people close to the victim. In this case, it was Fred van der Pfeffer, who was Inga's boyfriend at the time.
Altbecker says in South Africa, crimes like these follow an all-too-familiar pattern. 58 murders are committed in South Africa every day. In two-thirds of those, the killer is known to the victim.
The scenario seemed depressingly familiar for the police. This had been a couple in love that had a fight about something, and Fred, in a fit of rage, had murdered her.
Forensic scientist David Klatso believes that for police, it would have been the obvious starting point of the investigation.
You can say only one thing about the frenzied attack on Inga, and that was that it was somebody who was acting in a frenzy of blows. I mean, there were many blows rained down on her and many stab wounds. And it is unusual to find two different instruments used to murder somebody. Normally, people are quite happy to just use one murder weapon. And the ferocity of the attack indicates some emotional component. Either that or a drug-induced component.
Inga had been lying on the couch, wearing her pajama shorts and watching a DVD she had rented earlier that afternoon. She had finished her classes for the day at Stellenbosch University, where she was in her final year of actuarial science. Her apartment complex was brand new, and the tiler who had been fixing a tile on her balcony had finally left. She could relax alone in her apartment at last. But at some time after 4 p.m., the exact time has never been established, she was attacked from behind and murdered. At 3:30 p.m., CCTV cameras captured Inga renting that DVD, 2004's The Stepford Wives, starring Nicole Kidman, and buying a magazine from the Spar grocery store. Fred had spent the previous night at Inga's flat, but had left earlier to attend a class and then go to work at Old Mutual. One would expect Fred's fingerprints to be discovered throughout Inga's apartment. The cover of that DVD would be the only place you would not expect to find his prints.
His fingerprints were found on the cover of that DVD. If those fingerprints are his, he's placed at the crime scene at a time when he says he wasn't there.
And those prints the police said they collected from the DVD cover are indeed Fred's. Forensic scientist David Klatzo said the evidence against Fred began to mount when police took a closer look at a blood mark on the bathroom floor.
The second piece of evidence was the so-called bloody mark on the floor of the bathroom. That was identified as a footprint by Bruce Bartholomew, who was a captain in the South African police force at the time and was expert on shoe marks and print marks made by shoes, tires, and the like. Not only did Bruce Bartholomew identify it as a footmark, he identified it unequivocally as a footmark made by Fred's training shoe.
But that wasn't all.
When she was conducting the autopsy, the pathologist looked at all the various injuries that Inga had sustained and told the police that she thought they should look for a hammer. When they searched Fred's car, they found an ornamental hammer that had been given to him by Inga's parents a few months before for Christmas.
The third piece of evidence was the fact that they said that the hammer, which had a bottle opener on one side for opening bottles and a small hammer on the other side, they said that the marks on Inga's head, the wounds, fitted the hammer, and that it could be linked to a tool of the same size and dimensions and properties as that hammer.
And then, Altbecker says, police found the motive they had been looking for.
The final straw was that when the police searched Fred's briefcase, they found a letter that Inga had written to him on the morning she was murdered. In that letter, she promises never to go behind his back and apologizes for a range of things which suggested to them that a fight must have taken place between Fred and Inga. The evidence seemed overwhelming. They had all this forensic evidence. They had the letter that suggested a fight. All they didn't have was an eyewitness and a confession. But otherwise, this seemed like an open and shut case.
The South African media went into a frenzy. Every day, a new twist, a titillating headline. It was a story the public could not get enough of.
It's a murder that shocked the university town of Stellenbosch. A 22-year-old student was stabbed and beaten to death 3 months ago.
In our top story, police say the net is tightening around a suspect in the Inga Lotz murder case. Evidence is mounting against one man.
In breaking news, it's emerged that the police's main suspect in the Inga Lotz murder case is her boyfriend, Fred van der Pfeffer.
Its coverage was intense from the very beginning. It was on page one from day one, and it never left.
Three months after her death, on the 15th of June 2005, Fred van der Pfeffer handed himself over to police and was officially charged with the murder of Inga Lotz. But he continued to maintain his innocence, insisting that he had been at work the entire afternoon and had witnesses to corroborate his story. The day before the murder, he had made a presentation of a new financial product. The 16th of March, the day of Inga's murder, was the question and answer session. Fred's presence at that meeting was crucial to his defense alibi. Fred claimed he had left Inga's flat at around 9 that morning to attend a lecture at Stellenbosch University. At 10:30, Fred and Inga met briefly on campus where she handed him a letter. The state would make much of this letter, believing it a vital piece of the puzzle, a clue to Fred's motive. Fred then went to Old Mutual, where he insisted he stayed until 6 p.m., He then drove straight home to the apartment he shared with Marius Buerta, just 5 minutes away from where he worked. After helping Marius deliver a kitchen unit to a neighboring apartment, he became worried about Inga's whereabouts when his text messages went unanswered. Cell phone records show that the two messaged each other frequently. On that evening, however, she did not respond to multiple messages and missed calls from both Fred and her mother. At about 10 that night, Fred drove to Inga's parents' house to collect a spare set of keys to her apartment. Meanwhile, his flatmate Marius asked his friend, who lived close to Inga, to check in on her. That friend, Christo, was the one who made the gruesome discovery. Inga's door had been left unlocked, and when Christo entered and saw her body on the couch, he thought she had committed suicide. It was Marius who had to break the news to Fred and Inga's mother. Fred appeared devastated. Less than a week later, he recited a William Blake poem at her funeral. But behind the scenes, police had already identified him as their main suspect. His defense was simple. He had been in meetings at his workplace the entire day. Colleagues were willing to corroborate Fred's story, but witness testimony is notoriously unreliable, and the forensic evidence appeared bulletproof.
Fred was denying it. Now, there are two possibilities. One, he did it and denied it. One, he didn't do it and denied it. And I had no means of determining which of the two was true.
On the next episode of the Inga Lott story, A Miscarriage of Justice.
It was tunnel vision and led them down the wrong path.
Fred gave him a full alibi from the very time that he left Stellenbosch until he heard about the tragic news. Killers don't do that.
Let his son rot in prison. Those were his exact words.
This episode was produced by Matthew Brown and Catherine Rice for News 24. Audio recording by Matt Gare, Craig Reinefeldt and Luke Peters. Music courtesy of Getty Images and Epidemic Sound. News reports were recreated and voiced by Sheldon Marias, Annika Larson and Melanie Rice. Multimedia editors, Charlene Ruert and Nokutula Manyati. News 24 Editor-in-Chief, Adrian Besson. For other News 24 podcasts, visit our multimedia page where you can find Exodus, White Collar Heist and Missing Matthew. For more exclusive content, subscribe to news24.com.